Let's turn now to Jesus and the Enlightenment. We've just talked about the great pietistic transatlantic revival called the Great Awakening, the first half of the 18th century. Let me say something explicitly that I didn't say, that I said implicitly yesterday or Monday. One of the most important results of the Great Awakening was to forever legitimate emotion and emotional expression in American religion. The Awakening legitimated emotion and emotional expression in American religion. But as we discovered last time, there is an irony involved in this. For this emotion-laden revival occurred in the midst of the Enlightenment, which focused instead on reason and the life of the mind. Not emotion and the heart, but reason and the life of the mind. The tensions between those two forces, reason and emotion, heart and mind, the tension between these two forces defines in many important ways the 18th century. The first half of the 18th century, as I hope that at least some of you know, the first half of the 18th century sees the growing influence of scientific and moral revolution of the Enlightenment as it begins to affect the religious beliefs in the Atlantic world. In the second half of the century, these liberal or enlightened ideas became quite common, especially among the elite of British America. These enlightened ideas are especially prevalent among the men who found the American nation. And they are very important for our understanding of the changes of the views of Jesus in the 18th century mind. Keep in mind at all times that everything we're talking about takes place simultaneously, exactly as the evangelical world of emotion is also emerging. All of the enlightened beliefs about religion that we're going to be talking about today shared one basic assumption. They believed that true religion was natural religion. Can anyone tell me what that means in opposition to? Natural as opposed to what? The word, revelation. Let's go. Let's keep with the R's. Natural religion, revealed religion, revealed in scriptures, revealed for Christians in the word. But for the 18th century enlightened mind, true religion was very unlike revealed religion. Revealed religion, they said, almost always became corrupted and too often became the tool of oppression by the state. And it made men bigoted and narrow and dangerous, even lethal. Natural religion, however, was based on the operations of, guess what? Natural, the root word is? Nature, based on the operations of nature, the natural world. And the most important component of that natural world was the human mind and its ability to reason. Most of these folks believed in some sort of a God. We're going to talk about various kinds of beliefs about God. But for most of them, he was something called, something called Providence, capital P, please. Reason had been given to man by Providence with which to discern the laws of nature. We were given reason to discern the laws whereby the universe and the natural world operated. And we were to use our rational capacities to discern
the morals and ethics by which humans should live their lives. We should use that rational power to also discern the morals, the ethics by which we should live our lives as human beings. And the emphasis on natural religion was on those moral and ethical dimensions of life. Natural religion expressed itself in a moral, ethical life. Some of them call themselves deists, from the word deity. The deist. Folks, all of you heard the word deist at least? What do we say? A belief opposed to the theistic belief in an immanent God. What's an immanent God? Was it? Close. Immanent God. As opposed to what? Transcendent God out there. Immanent God right here. A belief opposed to the theistic belief in an immanent God that was involved in the history and in the daily lives of men. God, divine providence, had created the universe that led it to run its ordered course according to divinely ordained ideas, laws that could be known to man by the divinely bestowed powers of reason. Reasons, folks, that's a pretty good definition of deism. The deists rejected one of the basic precepts of Christian orthodoxy. The belief that a creator God continued to be involved in the daily operations of history and in the affairs of men. No, they said. They did not subscribe, in other words, to the orthodox belief in an immanent God that constantly intervened in our lives. For them, God was instead the first mover, the creator, divine providence, if you will, who brought the universe into being and then left it to run its course according to divinely ordained laws. Our divinely ordained laws that, guess what? We can know. And in knowing those laws, what do we encounter? Whom do we encounter? God. How you learn, that's how you encounter and know God. Now, at the beginning of class, I played for you an excerpt from Haydn's great oratorio, The Creation. A paean, hymn of praise to the Creator God. But we can also go American at this point. William Billings, here he is again. William Billings, late 18th century, was the first great American poser. New England, Boston, a tanner by trade, self-taught, never had a music lesson in his life, wrote glorious a cappella music. And he wrote one called Creation, which also expresses the idea of the Creator God. But here, instead of like a great clock, folks, I assume you're all aware of the image of God as the great clockmaker. Winds it up, puts it on the shelf, tick, tock, tock, what happens then? What happens? It just keeps running. What happens to God? He leaves it alone. And what makes things happen in that clock? How does a clock run? Springs. You ever seen the intricacies of a clock, a big clock inside? I mean, they're very intricate. Springs going like this and everything. All right? Now, it's obviously possible at this point to believe in an immanent God. For instance, 1756, huge earthquake destroyed Lisbon. People had no problems believing in a creator God and saying that somewhere in there was a spring that said, Lisbon, your day is up today, right? Depends on how intricate you want your God to be. But he's not intervening himself daily, all righty? William Billings' idea of God was not as a clockmaker, but as an instrument maker. And here existence is compared to a harp. When I with pleasing wonder stand and with all my frame survey, Lord, 'tis thy work, the body, thy hand thus built my humble clay. Our life contains 1,000 strings and dies if one be gone, because it's so intricate and marvelous. strange that a harp of 1,000 strings should keep in tune so long. Jig in one of his songs. Others of these rational, reasonable men identified themselves as Unitarians. I don't even need a definition. Unitarians is easy. Unitarianism is a system of beliefs that emerged in the late 17th century in Old England and became increasingly popular and powerful among the New England Puritan educated elites in the second half of the 18th century. We're talking about the late 18th century now. English Unitarianism, as then embraced by New England, was defined by its general rejection of all of the Calvinistic inclinations toward predestination. And more specifically, by its rejection of the Trinitarian foundations of Orthodox Christianity. Unitarianism is part of a larger rejection in the 18th century of the miraculous and the supernatural components of Orthodoxy, especially as they came out in the life and ministry of Jesus. We've already met something like this. These folks sound a little bit like the 4th century Arian heresy. Check your notes for the first week of class. Arius had said that Jesus was not divine, but he was also not human. He was what? Do you remember? What was he? Somewhere in between. Good guess. We need a phrase, though. It's a special creation. He wasn't with God before time. He wasn't with God like the Word. He wasn't created when we were created. He was instead a special creation. They didn't say when, but don't push. A special creation with a special role in the salvific plan for mankind. Arian. And others simply believed that Jesus was, what's all that's left? Just a human? Just an enlightened human? There are lots of enlightened humans, right? Even if I never heard of that, I would say, I bet you there was. I bet you there was, yeah. But it's not just an enlightened human. How many enlightened humans have there been? Lots of them. What was your goal? What were you going to say? Just any old prophet? Come on, let's set him apart a little bit. He's Jesus, for God's sake. How about a very enlightened person? How about a super prophet? Like whom? Moses. Let's put him with the big guys. Name another one. Muhammad. I'm serious, actually. Muhammad. Can you name another? Buddha. Got it. Put him up there, the big guys. The really super, super humans. Folks, no one, I hope no Muslim believes that the prophet is God. That's a real serious problem, right? The prophet is the prophet. Jesus is just a really, really great guy. Not just another human, a kind of a super human. Are you reading about someone who believes something like that? I hope you are. Some of these folks call themselves Socinians. I'm sorry, I do not make up these words. Guess what we need a definition of. Ideas first proposed by Faustus Socinius. That's a great name. A 16th century Italian rationalist. Denied the Trinity, the divinity of Christ. He denied the natural depravity of man, eternal punishment, etc. And taught that salvation was to be attained by imitating Christ's virtue and that the Bible should be interpreted in light of human reason. There's no really one thing to call these people. They are simply rationalists, enlightened men. They never founded the first deist church. They did finally found the first Unitarian church. We're going to get to that. These are belief systems that have things in common. Yes, Katie. Salvation isn't just to escape eternal punishment. Why should we also be saved? Or just better lives. Any other questions? All righty. Yes. Takes a long time. Jordan's question is, why did it take so long? Folks, it takes a long time for unbelief or any kinds of chipping away at rational orthodoxy to begin to take hold. And the key to that process is something called the Enlightenment. That's where we are. But when these folks began to have these thoughts, they then had access to 16th and 17th century thinkers who could be seen then as precursors. Now, I need now to try to relate all of this to the American Revolution, the central event of American history. The Civil War is not the central event of American history. The Revolution is. The event that created the nation and our identity as a people. Now, many of the founders, I would say most of them, actually, rejected traditional views of Jesus and his divinity, and we're going to talk more about that. But these same people had no hesitation in invoking traditional Puritan views about the special relationship between the colonies and God in order to defeat England. One of the first thing that all of the leaders did in one way or another was to invoke the city on a hill heritage of their Puritan ancestors, that God had had a special role to play in the creation of America, and that America had a special role to play in the world. In the American Revolution, the founders created a secular vision of that Puritan idea of a city on a hill. And their firmest allies in this tremendously important process was the clergy. Especially in New England, the clergy were crucial in interpreting the fact that, hello, we won the American Revolution. We weren't supposed to, you know. The first time a colony had successfully risen up and thrown off, in modern times, the mother country. And the founders had to explain that. And they had real easy access to an explanation. It had been the will of Providence that we defeat the English. So, the clergy and then secular leaders, the clergy developed and then the secular leaders used, and I don't think cynically at all, they used a providential interpretation of the American victory in the Revolution, arguing that God had assisted them and their leaders at every step of the war. For instance, they argued that God had sent the French and Indian War of the 1650s and 60s for a reason related to the Revolution. Can anyone tell me what that reason might be? What might be a providential interpretation of the French and Indian Wars? Yes. Well, France is on the other side. Huh? The French Indian War was the reason they cracked out. Well, we know that. I'm not sure the colonies did that. The French, that's very good, Jason, create a local American military. And what did that military get to do in the Revolution? Come on. What did they do? From the perspective of the Revolution, what did they do? They trained them. Folks, they practiced. Come on. Especially what particular American military leader? George Washington. Who knew the French Indian War was to give George Washington on-the-job training? And they were very serious about this. And you know what? I don't know about Providence, but he really did learn how to be a guerrilla warrior in the war. And it made a difference. Who are we to say God didn't do that? Maybe they were right. He also sent to the English, they argued, especially stupid and bad generals, who more or less then lost the war for the English. Over and over again, they talked about the colonies as David, and the English, of course, then as Goliath. Yes, Jordan. Folks, if that's the way you want to interpret it, that's exactly what they could do. Sure. Actually, they don't usually try to fit big events like that. What they really have to deal with is, I mentioned that earthquake a while ago. This really happened. In 1756, Lisbon was destroyed by a horrible earthquake. And it's important, actually, because guess what scientists did for the first time in explaining the earthquake? They were inventing seismology. And so a whole big debate then came about where did the earthquake come from? Before, where did earthquakes come from? God. End of discussion. The Lisbon earthquake, huge catastrophe, led to discussions about providence working in the world. And some American and English scientists began to talk about maybe there are plates around and the continents are floating, but who knows? But it may be beyond God, right? But the idea of a clockmaker God could explain it anyhow. All righty? Maybe I'm going to regret throwing that clockmaker thing in. I see some furrowed brows. We'll see. When the Continental Congress met to form a government, one of the first things they had to do was to come up with a great seal of the United States. Stamp all the documents. What is the great seal of the United States? What's on one side? Not them. What's the picture? There's an eagle, right? Rampant, standing up like this. Got in one talon what? Arrows, weapons, what else? Over here, olive branch, you choose, right? But we're an eagle, right? Turn it over. Not a turkey, by the way. Turn it over. What's on the other side of the dollar bill? The pyramid with the eye, that freaky kind of thing. What kind of symbol is that? Well, it is actually. Oh, God, I forgot who I'm talking to. Everyone knows about this crap. How many of you have seen the movie? How many of you have read the code? Raise your hand. How have you read the Da Vinci Code? How have you saw the movie? That's interesting. Where have you folks been? Yeah. It's kind of Masonic. Masonry is one of the developments of the Enlightenment. Masonry is a kind of an innocuous, kind of a secret source of arcane, esoteric knowledge about becoming an adept. Getting extra knowledge is kind of Gnostic. Anyhow, that's beside the point. There was a committee. Three people, John Adams, Ben Franklin, and Thomas Jefferson. Now we know that Jefferson finally wins. He has the pyramid of wisdom, power and wisdom. The eye is the eye of providence. His eye, observe the beginning, the eye of providence is upon us. And under it, a quote from Virgil, Latin quote from Virgil, a new secular order. Quintessence of sort of liberal, non-theistic, traditional theistic religion. John Adams wanted the great seal of the United States to be a picture, an illustration from the life of Hercules. A classic illustration. It's called The Choice of Hercules. Can anyone tell me what The Choice of Hercules was? Anybody? At one point in his life, as a young man, Hercules has to choose between vice and virtue. Are you going to live a life of vice or a life of virtue? You decide. And classical artists, Renaissance, classical artists, often painted Hercules, always as a strapping young man, often in advanced stage of undress, by two women. One, always alluringly and fetchingly, usually blonde, was always holding the accoutrements of vice, and usually with an off-the-shoulder thing here. Accoutrements of vice, what? What could you be holding? A wine glass. What else? You don't have a gamble, do you? Dice, cards, right? And a kind of a come-hither look, right? On the other side is always virtue. Usually dark-haired, usually with some owner hair, and always very rather severe-looking, and she usually has in her hand the inevitable book. Virtue. You do. John Adams believed that the American Republic was at the point where we were going to have to decide if we were going to be virtuous or not. Were we going to be selfless enough to sustain Republican government? Aren't you glad that's not the Great Seal of the United States? Can anyone tell me what Ben Franklin's idea for the Great Seal was? Do you know? How do you think that his idea for the national bird was a turkey? The story, I don't think it was, actually. Get an idea. Ben Franklin, the epitome of the Enlightenment. I'm going to lecture to him about him next time. Do you know what that old man's idea for the Great Seal was? A chapter in the life and history of the children of Israel. He wanted the Great Seal of the United States to be a representation of the children of Israel being led by a pillar of fire across the Red Sea, protected by God. We were to be the new Zion, the new Israel. This from Ben Franklin. Can you imagine some draftsman trying to carve all of those little Israelites going across the... He was serious, though. The Great Seal was to be an invocation of our role as the new Zion. Now, my point is that these men, most of whom had very traditional ideas about Jesus, however, had some very traditional ideas about the role of God in the origins of the American Republic. At least for public consumption. We are now to be the inheritors of the Jews' covenant with God. Note, though, that the emphasis is on that traditional Jewish God and Christian God as Father. The new king of America was to be God. He was not to be Jesus. Let me turn then now to the Unitarian controversy and begin to talk to you more specifically about specific ideas about who Jesus was for the men who founded the Republic. Let's go to New England. The New England heirs of the Puritans, who provided much of the leadership for the War of Independence and the creation of the new nation, these men had been fussing about the nature of Jesus for a couple of generations before the imperial crisis and the war that followed it. And in New England, especially, during those debates about Jesus, many of these men had become Unitarians. Among wealthier and better educated New Englanders in the latter half of the 18th century, Unitarianism grew very strong. Unitarians tried to isolate and emphasize only the rational and reasonable elements of revealed religion. We have the Bible, we need to use it, but we need to use only the rational and reasonable elements of revealed religion. And this led them to reject the divinity of Jesus and the miracles that for the Orthodox were at the basis of the belief in his divinity. Instead, the Unitarians focused on Jesus' teachings, and they focused on him as a moral and ethical example. And we now know that in the late 18th and early 19th century, some of these intellectuals who became Unitarians discovered the first sort of stirrings of what comes in the 19th century to be called the quest for the historical Jesus. As they discovered German universities, for instance, and the men who were writing in German universities, they began to encounter in the early 19th century men who were beginning to try to put Jesus into his historical context for the very first time. men who were interested in the ancient languages in which the scriptures were written and propagated. Men who were interested in the cultures in which they flourished. For these well-educated men, fascinated by this growing interest in the historical Jesus, Jesus for them became a moral and an ethical exemplar. The Jesus of the Unitarians was most like Luke's Jesus, Luke's teacher, much more than Matthew's preacher or Mark's apocalyptic mystery man. And there is in this Unitarian Christology none of the cosmic Christ of the fourth gospel of John. Now, I cannot tell you how forceful your aura as a class is telling me that this is the most boring stuff you've ever heard. I can see it. I'm very good about auras, and I can just feel it. Miller, no one cares. Tell you what, this gets really important. It's really important in the real world because New England Congregationalism, the most powerful force in American culture, is about to split over Unitarianism. And some of you were saying, Miller, I still don't care. Get a life, man. You know what? We're alone today. No, we're not. They're back there. Hi, y'all. I suddenly felt alone. Oh, so some of y'all are beginning to think, Miller's finally about to freak out. Young people, I turned 65 this month. I'm officially a retired person. I just get paid for it. Where the hell? Short of exploding, I'm trying to wake you up to tell you that what's about to happen is important. And I'm just too tired to explode. So here goes. In the last two decades of the 18th century, just as the new nation was being established, the unity of New England Congregationalism, which is what we now call the Puritan Church, the Congregational Church, was disappearing. One by one, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, virtually every congregational church in New England divided over the question of the nature of the Trinity. Are you going to be a Trinitarian Christian, an Orthodox Trinitarian Christian, or are you going to be a Unitarian Christian? And the forces, kiddos, were pretty evenly divided, actually. And one by one, the churches simply divided. And a new denomination of Christians emerged. And there was in New England a Unitarian church. An event catalyzed this. And it's important enough to bring up in a course, in a survey course, even like this. In 1804, the professor of moral philosophy, the theology professor at Harvard, died. He's the guy who's going to be at the forefront of training the leaders of the New England clergy, as they all go to Harvard, right? This man had been a staunch Trinitarian. But in 1804, the Harvard board appointed to succeed him a Unitarian. A man who did not believe in the Trinity and who did not believe in the divinity of Jesus. And the Trinitarians withdrew their support from Harvard. And they went a little bit to the west and created a new place to train preachers called a seminary. And they created in 1808 the Andover Theological Seminary. All of this over a debate about the divinity of Jesus. The first three presidents of the United States, Washington, Adams, and Jefferson, were all more or less openly Unitarian. Now, all three of them continued to belong to traditional Christian churches. Adams, for instance, never joined a Unitarian church, although he was a Unitarian in philosophy and theology. And Thomas Jefferson and George Washington remained sort of active in their local Episcopal churches after the Episcopal Church becomes the Episcopal Church out of the Church of England as a result of the Revolution. But these three men were all essentially Unitarian in their actual beliefs. John Adams told Thomas Jefferson in 1816, quote, "The Ten Commandments and the Sermon on the Mount contain my religion." The Ten Commandments and the Sermon on the Mount contain my religion. John Adams wrote that to Thomas Jefferson. What do the Ten Commandments and the Sermon on the Mount have in common? Was it? Guidelines. Like what kinds of guidelines, Katie? Guidelines for living. Sounds like a soap opera or something. They're all, are they concerned with salvation? No. Are they concerned with the miraculous? No. What are they concerned with? Talk to me. Making the world a better place? Moral. Living a life of morality. And another word, ethics. Folks, is that what you think religion is? Is that what you think religion is? No, most of you don't, actually. How many of you do? I don't know. Who knows? Who cares? I'm here to tell you, the guys who founded this country did believe that that's what this is all about.